The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Welcome to Deep Dive with the Institute for Justice. I'm Melanie Hildreth. With a record amount of unemployment facing Americans today, the ability to earn a living is top of mind for a lot of people. So with that in mind, I'm here today with IJ Senior Attorney Bob McNamara and IJ Attorney Josh Windham to talk about the ways that government introduces barriers to the ability to earn a living and the way that it can remove those barriers to work now more than ever when people need the ability to provide for themselves and for their families. So, Bob, can you start by talking about a couple of important developments that happened that have to do with this very issue in state Supreme Courts this week, one in Pennsylvania, one in Georgia? What happened in Georgia?
Absolutely. So in Georgia, the state Supreme Court handed down a major decision in which it affirmed that the state constitution protects what it calls the right to what we call economic liberty, rather, which is the right to pursue an honest living free from unreasonable government interference. We had brought a lawsuit on behalf of a group of lactation consultants. A lactation consultant is just someone who helps a new mother breastfeed, helps give advice on breastfeeding, and help kind of walk through the process, providing tips and emotional support. And there are a couple different organizations nationwide that certify lactation consultants, and one of them requires longer training. One of them does the training in fewer hours, and the group that requires longer training had gone to the Georgia legislature and said, hey, you know who should be the only people who are allowed to work as lactation consultants is us. It should just be us. And so we represent people who are certified through the other organization saying, actually, we've been doing this for years and we're good at it, and you can't just throw us out of work because somebody came and asked you to. And we had been thrown out of the trial court. The trial court said, no, Georgia state constitution doesn't protect the right to earn an honest living. You just don't have that right in Georgia, and so you guys can go find other jobs, I guess. And the Georgia Supreme Court this week said that's wrong. The Georgia constitution, the state constitution, absolutely protects your right to pursue the calling of your choice without unreasonable government interference. The government can interfere with the right for a good reason. It can do so reasonably, but it actually has to show something in order to throw you out of work. It can't just say, well, these guys asked me to, and they seemed nice, and so you shouldn't have a job anymore. And this matters because Georgia is recognizing this right under its state constitution. We've talked on the show before about the federal rational basis test. And if you try to vindicate your right to earn an honest living in federal court, you're subject to what's called the rational basis test, under which the court is going to uphold what the government's doing as long as on any conceivable set of facts, a rational person might think the government was advancing some legitimate interest. And I've been a litigator for almost 15 years now. I still don't understand how I'm supposed to litigate about whether something is conceivable. Like, do we all just sit in a circle and think really hard? Do we ingest certain substances and see what comes to mind? It's kind of an impossible test on its face. It's not a test you would apply if you wanted to take the right seriously. That said, it's a test we litigate under, we win cases under, but we also realize the federal constitution isn't the only game in town. The federal constitution is what governs and limits the federal government, but every single state has its own constitution. Every single state also limits government, also protects your rights. And a lot of those states have their own independent protections for the right to earn an honest living, which is exactly what Georgia recognized this week. It didn't say the Georgia Constitution protects your right to earn an honest living unless the government can imagine a reason to take it away, and once it imagines the reason, then the argument's over. What it said was, you have this right, and the government can't take it away unreasonably. These guys have stated a valid claim. The trial court shouldn't have thrown them out because our state constitution protects and has always protected this right to pursue your job, to earn an honest living in the calling of your choice.
And that's a similar sort of situation came down from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court as well. Josh, can you talk a little bit about how it played out there? It's just crazy that this was all in one week. A really great vindication of people's ability to work again right now when they need it more than ever.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. And it is crazy, but sometimes these things happen in bursts, you know. In Pennsylvania, we represent a woman named Sally Ladd who... the simplest way I could describe her job is that she helps people post and coordinate rentals on sites like Airbnb, people who live in the Poconos and have a vacation home out there. she kind of helps them coordinate that so that they don't have to deal with it all. It's a really simple job. She does it from home, kind of in her PJs at her kitchen table in New Jersey. And, you know, she's in her 60s. She was thinking about retiring soon. And she thought this would be a great way to earn some income in my retirement. If I just kind of manage properties for a few friends, this is a great sustainable business for myself. Well, she got a call in 2017 from the Pennsylvania Bureau of Professional and Occupational Affairs, which is a lovely sounding. Yeah, I know. An investigator called her and said, look, this is the unlicensed practice of real estate. And if you want to keep working, you have to get a real estate broker's license. So she said, okay, well, maybe that's reasonable. Let me go look at what the license requirements are. And so she checked them out, and it was spend 3 years apprenticing for an established broker, take hundreds of hours of courses on general real estate practice, so buying and selling properties for the most part, and open a physical brick and mortar office in Pennsylvania. All of that was largely irrelevant to what she wants to do, and she can't afford and doesn't need a physical office in Pennsylvania to do this work. So Sally,
and even if she had one right now, she couldn't go to it.
I know. So Sally went to court, represented by us at the Institute for Justice, and she was thrown out, like our plaintiffs in Georgia. Basically, the trial court held that she did not state a valid constitutional claim because the real estate licensing law has a general valid purpose, which is protecting buyers and sellers of property from fraud and abuse. And so these requirements are reasonable when you apply them to people who buy and sell property for others. Now, again, Sally doesn't do that. She doesn't want to do that. She will never do that. And so we appealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and the court reversed yesterday, saying basically, look, the right to earn an honest living is a protected right under our state constitution. The test the court has to apply is more stringent than the federal rational basis test. It requires a real and substantial relationship to the government's stated purpose when you apply economic regulation to somebody. And the impact of that law can't be unduly oppressive on their rights. And that's the ground on which the court held, look, you've presented a colorable claim here. This has to go back down to the trial court.
And this is important because it isn't just something that will apply right now to Sally or to lactation consultants in Georgia. This is actually setting forth new law that will apply to other people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, this is not a decision that's limited to Sally. There was a general statement of the fact that Pennsylvania's constitution has, for about 75 years now, provided greater protection than the U.S. Constitution for economic liberty. So, you know, further plaintiffs can follow up Sally's suit and say, look, my rights have been violated too. This licensing scheme or this regulation is oppressive as applied to me. And that's a wonderful thing.
And the court in Pennsylvania explicitly referenced another IJ case that deals with this exact same issue from Texas. And Bob, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that case and what it meant at the time when it came down and the ways that it's playing out now in Pennsylvania and Georgia and elsewhere.
Absolutely. So one of my favorite parts about the Pennsylvania opinion, outside of the fact that it's a win for economic liberty, which I love, and a win for Josh, who I love, is the fact that it explicitly reaches out and says, what we're doing looks an awful lot like what the Texas Supreme Court did in this case called Patel. And in Patel, we had brought a challenge to a Texas requirement that people who did eyebrow threading, the ladies who have the thread they use to sort of noose off unwanted eyebrow hairs, had to become fully licensed cosmetologists and had to go to school for 750 hours. And we won that case in the Texas Supreme Court in a massive sea change in how Texas courts were reviewing these things, where the Texas court said, look, we do not apply the federal rational basis test. We're not going to apply the federal rational basis test because Texas's constitution takes the right to earn an honest living seriously. And that means we're going to do two things. We're going to require this real and substantial relationship, again, like you see in Pennsylvania, and we're going to look at whether the law is unduly burdensome, unduly oppressive. And that's really the piece that, for my money, makes the most difference in how these state courts are analyzing the right. They're not saying, look, let's look at this in the abstract and whether it's conceivable that this law is achieving something. Let's actually look at the people who are in the courtroom. Let's look at the people who are in front of us. And in Texas, you had to go to school for 750 hours to be a fully licensed cosmetologist. And even the state, when looking at those hours, the best they could muster is if you looked really hard and you kind of squinted, about half those hours were relevant to eyebrow threading. They didn't teach any eyebrow threading. They didn't test any eyebrow threading. But about half of those hours, they argued, had something to do with sanitation, and eyebrow threaders should wash their hands. So it makes sense for them to have to go to school because they have to wash their hands. And what the Texas Supreme Court basically said is, look, everybody has to wash their hands. Doctors have to wash their hands. And if the best you can muster for 750 hours of education is that half of it is kind of sort of relevant, that's not a great reason to make somebody be in school for 750 hours when you concede half of it is wasting their time, even on your view. And that, I think, is the massive and important thing, because you really, in justice, can't evaluate these laws in the abstract. If Josh Windham walks into court and says, hey, the government threw me out of my job, it seems unreasonable for me to say, well, the government threw you out of your job, Josh, but this law makes a certain amount of sense when you apply it to Melanie. And you say, well, Melanie's not here. I'm the one who wants to work. I'm the one who has a claim of constitutional right here. And I say, yeah, but it's really important that Melanie wash her hands. The government should be accomplishing something for the public by the thing it's doing to you, by the thing you're objecting to in this case, which is something it can be hard to get federal courts to pay attention to. But what we now see is an emerging doctrine in the state courts under state constitutions where even though every state has its own constitution and those constitutions are independent, they're really looking at each other and developing a doctrine. Pennsylvania isn't operating in a vacuum. They're looking out across the country in a scholarly way and saying, oh, there are parallels between our constitution and Texas's constitution. There are parallels between what we're doing and what Texas is doing. And you're really seeing an emerging doctrine, not just of taking economic liberty seriously, of taking your right to pursue an honest living seriously, but of really talking about how we're going to take that right seriously, what it looks like for a court to evaluate it, what kind of evidence matters, and what kinds of claims are going to be victorious. And watching courts across state lines develop that doctrine is a much more robust way of protecting economic liberty and of protecting all of our ability to kind of seek the job we want without unreasonable or arbitrary interference from the government.
So we're seeing this develop in state courts and in the law, but we care a lot about real world results here. So we're talking about, you know, who all this impacts. What are we seeing in places like Texas that have had this as the rule for a number of years in terms of the way that it actually plays out? Like, are people not washing their hands now that they're not getting 750 hours of reminders to do so? Is there evidence that there are drawbacks that we couldn't have foreseen, or how does it look? You know, how does it look in Texas and other states that have followed their lead for the people who have to live with the new rule?
So people in Texas are definitely washing their hands, especially now. but I think what we're really seeing is actually exactly what you would hope to see when you have robust judicial review of economic regulations. Our vision, kind of IJ's vision, is not to let a million lawsuits bloom all across the country. And for the way you vindicate your right to earn an honest living to be to go to court and litigate for 3 years with Josh and me representing you. The actual end game is that you shouldn't have to go to court. The government should respect your right in the first place. It shouldn't be doing this to you in the first place. And our vision is that the way you stop the government from doing that is you let them know that on the back end, there's going to be serious review. You let the government officials know there's going to be serious review. You let the lobbying groups know there's going to be serious review. So if your argument really is you should pass a law that lets me and my buddies work and throws our competition out of business, maybe you don't put a lot of lobbying muscle behind that law if you know it's not going to stand up in court. And we're in part starting to see that in Texas. We're starting to see genuine changes in administrative agency behavior. And an actual directive came a while back from the governor's office, sort of warning administrative agencies that as you're passing regulations, as you're considering enforcement actions, you need to be careful. You need to be careful to be doing things for a good reason as applied to the particular person you're doing them to. And that is, you know, of course, we would always hope that everyone in government act virtuously and perfectly and with foresight all the time, it concentrates the mind to know that there's going to be serious judicial review. And so there's been no spike of great danger to the public that we've been able to discern, but we have seen exactly what you would want, which is the beginnings of different behavior from government officials because they've been put on notice that the Texas courts are open for business. The Texas courts are going to look at evidence, and the Texas courts are going to ask you why you did what you did. And if you know you have to answer that question, it genuinely does put a little more effort. It requires you to put a little more effort into it on the front end. The old saying is that nothing focuses the mind like a hanging in the morning, but a bench trial does the same thing pretty well, too.
Yeah, and if I could add just one quick point to that, I mean, one thing that, you know, opponents of a sort of heightened rational basis test or a more rigorous review in state courts often throw at these arguments is, well, if courts strike down economic regulations or stand up for your right to earn a living, then that's violating the separation of powers, right? That somehow judges are acting as the legislators. But I mean, what Bob said, I think, kind of illustrates that what it really does is establishes a healthy relationship between the branches. If the courts do their job, the legislature has to take its job seriously. And that's what we want.
So this is really exciting. At the state level, what we're seeing from the regulators, the legislators, the courts, what does it mean for, when we started talking, Bob referenced the federal rational basis test, what does it mean for federal courts and for the Supreme Court? Is that really a fight that we're going to step away from right now, or does it change our strategy? How do we look at the federal courts in light of this kind of state-based change?
Oh, I mean, we're definitely not stepping away from the federal courts. We have economic liberty cases ongoing in federal courts across the country. We expect to win all of them, and we expect to file more. But I think the thing this really says for the federal courts is that it provides real on-the-ground evidence. You know, Josh mentioned a minute ago that some people object to the idea of any robust review of economic regulations, and the argument always comes down to the sky will fall. There will be a million lawsuits. Every regulation will be struck down. We'll have, you know, brain surgeons with no training on street corners and cats and dogs living together, and it will be mass hysteria. And until Patel came down, until there started to be this sort of growing body of state court doctrine, it was kind of an abstract argument where people would say the sky will fall, and we would say, no, it won't. And it is much more persuasive to say, instead of no, it won't, no, it hasn't. What we can provide now is real practical evidence of what happens when courts are in the business of applying this kind of robust review, that the sky doesn't fall, and a growing body of doctrine that shows you how courts can do it, and that courts are competent to do it, and that courts can recognize the cases where things have gone too far, that they do have that basic competence to weigh the evidence as they do in every other area. And I think we're seeing that proof on the ground in all of these states that are adopting and applying the kind of rules that IJ's been advocating for years. And it puts the courts in the role where I think they're supposed to be. You know, Josh talked about the separation of powers and the idea that courts shouldn't be sitting as super legislatures. And of course they shouldn't. Legislators should legislate, and judges should judge. And nothing about judges judging is in conflict with legislators legislating. But I think the key analytical difference, and what we're really seeing emerging in the state courts, is that judges judging means they're not sitting in judgment of the wisdom of an entire piece of legislation and saying, oh, real estate broker licensing is a bad idea, it's a bad policy. What they're doing is what judges have done for centuries, is looking at the particular case in front of them. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court didn't say that Pennsylvania's real estate licensing law is unconstitutional. It didn't say the legislature has to rewrite the law. What it said was, when you look at what the agency is actually doing to this woman relative to what they can be expected to gain by making this woman take a 3-year apprenticeship, it doesn't make any sense. Applying this law to her in these circumstances is nuts, and you shouldn't be able to do things that are nuts because we care about individual rights and the right to earn an honest living. And being able to bring that to federal courts, someday to the U.S. Supreme Court, and say, look, there's no reason to have zero-level review here as a practical matter is 10 years, 15 years, 20 years of state courts actually doing this, and here's what it looks like on the ground, and here's what happens when judges have this tool in their arsenal, is an enormously persuasive argument. So we're litigating in Texas and Georgia and Pennsylvania because we care about Texas and Georgia and Pennsylvania, and we care about the rights of the people who live in Texas and Georgia and Pennsylvania. But we're also doing it because winning cases in Texas, Georgia, and Pennsylvania is, as a practical matter, a good way to vindicate the rights of people in New Jersey, New York, and Delaware.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court, just to add one point to that, I mean, has a long history of looking at what state high courts have done in areas it's considering for perhaps the first time or reconsidering. And so this is a traditional way of achieving, you know, constitutional change in both the federal and state courts. And the Supreme Court's done it for you know, over a century.
So when I started our conversation today, I mentioned the current state of the world, unemployment right now. What do these kinds of, I mean, these are cases that preceded the pandemic, will go on after the pandemic, but what do they mean for this current moment, for the people, millions and millions of people right now who kind of need a reason for optimism when it comes to their ability to work and what their government is going to do to stand in the way or to facilitate that?
And I think there are reasons for optimism precisely because they show that life does go on. I think a big concern a lot of people have had with the pandemic is governments are assuming extraordinary powers. And a lot of people are worried that when the government assumes extraordinary powers, it is not especially eager to give them back. And that's a reasonable concern. There's certainly plenty of historical evidence that once government grabs power, it keeps that power and wields that power in new circumstances. And I think what we see in these decisions is a good reason to hope and believe that that will not be the case, and especially with the Pennsylvania decision. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court just a few weeks ago handed down what was the first state high court decision about a quarantine order issued in the course of the pandemic in a case called Friends of Danny DeVito, which remains my favorite case name of all time.
Friends of Danny DeVito.
Aren't we? Aren't we, though? It's everyone.
It is.
The state of Pennsylvania. Friends of Danny DeVito is a political campaign committee, but I refuse to care about that fact. But what the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said in that case, they ruled against the Friends of Danny DeVito, and they said, nope, we want no part of this. If there is a pandemic, then the government's going to have broad sweeping powers, and we're going to authorize it to do as it sees fit, and we're not going to interfere in this. And what you see in the case handed down this week is saying, but in cases where you're not able to show us that there's a broad pandemic requiring emergency powers, we're going to put the government to its proof. If there's a restriction on liberty, we're going to demand that the government provide some proof for why it's doing what it's doing. And I think being able to win cases like this is kind of the path forward and the way to have some assurance that once the pandemic passes, as the pandemic is passing, that there is a way to ensure that government doesn't exceed its bounds, that government goes kind of back in the box after the crisis passes. And the way to make government go back in the box is to have a robust judiciary there waiting to enforce limits on government and enforce individual rights. And I think we should be very heartened that the same court that said in the face of a pandemic we're going to be extremely deferential turned around a few weeks later and said, and also evidence matters in our cases, so everybody keep your noses clean.
Thank you so much, Bob, and thank you, Josh, for joining me. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find more on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to subscribe.